Just because you wrestle alligators for a living doesn't mean you should have the skin of one. Say goodbye to dry and cracked skin with Old Spice Super Hydration Body Wash with vitamin B3. Made for 24/7 renewing moisturization with daily use. With scents of vanilla and shea, people will think you've taken up candle making as one of your hobbies. And there is nothing wrong with that. Old Spice Super Hydration Body Wash. Shop Old Spice now.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. I need another 1,000.
I admire your courage, Mish.
Trench. Sylvia Trench. I admire your luck, Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
Two historic movie introductions going on there in that early scene from 1962's Dr. No. Sean Connery as Bond, James Bond, and Bond's legendary theme music written by Monty Norman and arranged by John Barry. This week's Film Spotting Top 5, themes, movie themes.
Is it just me or do we sound much, much cooler with this Bond music playing underneath us?
We'll take all the help we can get.
Joining us this week for the Top 5, movie score fanatic Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. Michael will also join us for our review of Gravity, the acclaimed new sci-fi film from Alfonso Cuarón. That and more.
Now I know why Michael wanted us to call him Honey Writer this week.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio.
For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM10. You're listening to Film Spotting. Herman, Steiner, Williams, Morricone, Bernstein. Musical heavyweights will be battling for top five primacy later in the show when we count down our favorite movie themes. And speaking of heavyweights, our very own regular guest here on Film Spotting, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. Michael, it's so great to have you back.
If I was a real heavyweight, I would have my own theme.
That's
we
true.
We need to get a theme for Michael.
I feel very bantamweight here.
I like that idea.
We have a lot of listeners out there who are musicians, and I'm sure many of them will be cooking up their own Michael Phillips theme. I can't wait to hear what they come up with.
But first, life in space is impossible. Reviewing Gravity? Let's find out.
Do you copy?
Yes, they call me. I'm detached.
Give me your position.
I don't know. I'm spinning. I can't.
Report your position.
GPS is down. It's down. I can't.
Give me a visual.
I told you nothing. I see nothing.
You have a visual of Explorer.
No.
You have a visual of ISS.
No.
You need to focus. Anything. The sun and the Earth. Give me coordinates.
I can't breathe.
You're burning oxygen. You have to sip, not gulp.
There are probably a lot of places we could start our discussion of Gravity, but since we're devoting our show largely to music, I thought we'd begin with sound. Lest anyone forget the classic Alien tagline, Michael, can you do us the honors?
In space, no one can hear you scream.
Exactly. Gravity opens with a bit of text informing us that sound doesn't travel in space, and yet the movie is full of sounds. From Stephen Price's score to the radio tunes George Clooney's astronaut Matt Kowalski listens to while spacewalking, controls beeping inside capsules, the desperate breathing of Sandra Bullock's Dr. Ryan Stone as she gets detached from her ship during an unexpected debris storm and is left floating, seemingly hopelessly, with no way to communicate with Matt or ground control. Of course, there's also the most common of movie sounds, post-jazz singer, dialogue. And it's in the dialogue where Cuarón and his co-screenwriting son Jonas strategically fill us in on a little bit of Dr. Stone's backstory, which may come out in our conversation, but I won't divulge here. And they underline the key theme of their story, A survival and mission gone wrong tale at its core, Gravity might just end up being the most spectacle-filled meditation on grief you'll ever put on 3D glasses for. Michael, was the film's use of sound, specifically the dialogue, a strength? Or would you have preferred more heavy breathing and beeping controls?
Well, I always prefer heavy breathing, but but in this context, I think this is a film that really has figured out a way to make audiences pay attention to the story in about a dozen different ways at once. And I think this is partly why I think audiences are really responding strongly to it. We'll see in the second and third week. Not to talk like a businessman, but it opened very well the first weekend. And it's certainly the one thing everybody can agree on, I think, is that it's worth it to see it in 3D. I've seen it twice in 3D. I have not yet seen it in IMAX, and I think that that's apparently, and I think obviously the optimum way to kind of go with this thing, because it is the most immersive 3D feature since Avatar, and it's the first one since then, I think, that where you just, to see it in any other circumstance besides the biggest available nearby screen is a stupid way to see it. You know, sound and dialogue. My quibbles with the picture, which are not major, have to do with this sort of workmanlike aspect of the dialogue. I think when you do get the backstory and the explanations start coming about why Stone finds yourself in space to begin with, even before things go wrong, you can tell it's sort of a young man's effort at writing a middle-aged woman. I'm pinning most of this, I guess, on Jonas Cuarón, the son. Although I was surprised to find out that he's in his early 30s and not about 20 or 21, because it's got that sort of youthful, earnest, good-try quality in the same way that, I don't know, this may be kind of a squirrely line of thought, but I mean, James Cameron wrote the basic outline of Avatar when he was in high school.
Yeah, it shows.
And it absolutely shows. And I think in a more, in a mellower way, I think that it also, Gravity has that sort of working slightly against it, mm-hmm. too. Now, that said, I do think the use of sound is really sharp in the way it just comes in and out and makes intelligent compromises about how realistic it is or how realistic it isn't in terms of the sounds you would actually hear or not up there. I just love the idea, though, and I love the experience of the way this picture opens with this endless take. You know, 13, 15 minutes. I don't mean endless in a bad way. I mean like really enveloping, kind of an enrapturing take. Where you see everything around you in a way that we just haven't experienced in the movies in a while. And mm-hmm. it really does take you back to really kind of the birth of the movies, science fiction spectacle of the Méliès film From Earth to the Moon. It's that special looking. Now, is the film a game changer? Does it rewrite the rules of cinema? All the phrases I've been reading. For whatever reason, guys, I don't know yet if that's the case. I do know that I was very eager to see it twice, and I did. And as Matt Singer very astutely tweeted out a while back, is rewatchability the same thing as quality? I don't know, but it's just been a long time since I've seen, this year anyway, seen a movie and then thought, yeah, wouldn't mind seeing that again.
Yeah.
Pretty damn soon.
Where it is unique, I think, is that it's so artfully engineered to make us believe we're out there in outer space. And the 3D is key to this in a way that I don't even think you can say a film like 2001, which we talked about recently, does, or the Star Wars pictures, or any of these sci-fi outer space classics do. They definitely have a sense of awe and wonder, but in terms of the viewer in the audience actually feeling like they're being there, this movie manages to do that through all sorts of techniques. The 3D, I never thought I'd say this, but you do have to see this in 3D. I wouldn't say Avatar benefited from its 3D. I don't think it hurt Avatar. I think Coraline is the film I'd point to that was improved by its 3D. This is the second film I've seen that actually benefits because it is so integral to the story. I mean, we need to get a sense of how far away tiny little things like hook clasps or pieces of rope are. What mm-hmm. I loved about this movie, for all the technology and all the space age stuff going on, is to realize how much of the basic work of astronauts depends on tethers and ropes and these things that you'll find in any marina. And the 3D really brings that alive to us because we get a sense of how far away that stuff is and where things are swirling around us. And so that opening sequence just does that in a completely mesmerizing way.
Yeah. Now, and it's totally wow cool. I mean that's the point of it. That's the effect of it. And there's subtler variations on that, too. I think later when Quaron, you're actually looking at something from behind her space helmet. So
right.
It's basically from Sandra Bullock's point of view. And the camera sort of pivots then outside the helmet. And then
it goes in and out.
Regarding
that's amazing.
Her. And it's like how, you know, and it doesn't jump out at you in a very kind of showboaty way. It's just like, wow, you know, really
sharp. And it's not
sharp.
A trick either, because that's a transference of perspective, because this is her story, or at least it should be her story. I'd argue there's a weakness to the film that relates to this. But that is one of those points where we realize, okay, this is going to be her narrative, and it subtly does that with that camera move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. It sounds like we're mostly all on the same page here with this movie. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking about the new film from Alfonso Cuarón called Gravity. And for me, that immersion really was key. And I've said this a few times on the show before, but there have only been a handful of movies I've seen. Memento is one of them, though very different visually. But Memento is one of them where when I walked out of the theater, I actually felt like I had to take a few moments to compose myself and sort of get my bearings again, because I had been so immersed in the world that was presented to me on screen that everything outside of it felt truly foreign to me. And I think you have to give the movie some credit for that. There is something impressive in that. And it goes back to that amazing long take, Michael, you touched on. The way the camera just floats in and out, it starts in that long take so wide and just keeps creeping in until we get more and more information about these people until, as you said, eventually we are inside her helmet and we're seeing things from her perspective. And that's such a key shift there. But just the fact that we never leave space throughout this whole thing. There's never a time where we see what's happening down on Earth. We hear about it, but that's about it. So we're always stuck in this world. And everything's so sensory. You touched on it, Josh, with the hooks and everything. You really feel like there were times where I found myself shifting in my seat.
Oh, sure.
Sometimes.
Yeah, my head was rolling about with the camera.
As if my movement might affect their trajectory and actually get them closer to what they're trying to hang on to. I mean, that's pretty amazing when a movie can have that kind of effect on you. So I really do give the film a lot of credit for that. But I guess I would say that I don't think the spectacle alone does it. I think there has to be some other connection. In a film like 2001, which, as you said, Josh, we recently talked about here on the show, there's an intellectual one, right? It's provocative. It's challenging. It's making you think the whole time and ponder some deep questions. With this movie, I don't think it's quite as intellectually stimulating, but there is an emotional resonance to the film. And you touched on it, Michael, when you talked about the backstory. Despite some clingy dialogue that you also said, and I think we'll get into it a little bit more, the fact is, I felt like that did work. I felt like they introduced her backstory and the baggage she's carrying with her out into space in a way that actually didn't seem sort of like they were exploiting the tragedy. I thought it was effective. It made me have more of an investment in her and also her survival and the other character, George Clooney's astronaut as well. So I really went for that. I just wish the actual execution of the backstory and the way that whole subplot plays out, I wish it was as live as George Clooney's spacewalking, you know?
Yeah, but it's so clearly inserted to get that reaction out of you. I mean, you could say that some of these camera techniques are manipulative to get us feel like we're immersive. I found those much less manipulative than this sudden insertion of a tragic backstory that very likely Clooney's character should already be aware of. I mean, it's just kind of he asks her about this, and this comes out because I felt this worry on the part of the film that we weren't going to be emotionally involved. They seem to know we've got the tech stuff down.
Yeah, we've got the look down. Yeah, yeah.
Now, how are we going to get that other level? And the way they go about it here, I think, is really hackneyed, not only in inserting that trauma, but also in their envisioning of these two characters, Bullock and Clooney. Bullock's really good here. Clooney was a huge distraction.
I think he's great.
And part... He's doing his Ocean's 11 Sinatra thing, ring-a-ding-dinging around her. It's a totally wrong tone for this thing. And what it does, it is emphasizes the gender dynamic, which I don't think is an enormous problem that it undoes the film, but it's certainly distracted for me because he's always coming to her aid, instructing her, teaching her, saving her. Repeatedly, he has to save her. And the problem is that the movie emphasizes this in that Clooney dialogue. He's talking about you're attracted to me, or he'll say something like, that's a silly name for a girl. I mean, he's just doing the complete – he's doing Clooney.
Yeah,
I think Clooney is a good actor,
but
he's not acting here. He's doing Clooney.
I think I'm with you on both points, Josh. I just think you're blaming the actor and not the writers here. I mean
– Yeah, but he can choose if he's going to go Michael Clayton or he's going to go Clooney. That's a choice he can make no matter what the dialogue is.
This role doesn't need Michael Clayton. It needs Danny Ocean.
It'd be a lot better.
That's what it gets.
I think you're right, Josh. I think I feel that there's a piling on aspect to the story itself in Gravity. And I don't feel that way in the film's visual approach because it is so elegant. And the fact that it's this I'm perfectly happy to say the film is just one grand trick after another visually, and it's also kind of more modest and obvious tricks after another. In the way you roll out the emotional tragedy in the background of the Ryan Stone character, I also think there's kind of just a Perils of Pauline aspect to the way things pile on toward the end, where you just think, "Yeah, enough already."
And
that's a more common blockbuster reaction.
Yeah.
Now 90% of Gravity, maybe 80% of Gravity, does not provoke a common blockbuster reaction because you are thrown in this situation at the beginning. And not introduced to the characters in any of the usual ways. You're not introduced to the world they're working in any of the usual ways because you're just simply up there floating with them without any obvious cutting going on. And Cuarón, the other great thing about him as a filmmaker is he, you know, it's not like this film is unedited. He knows exactly when to cut.
Yeah.
And I guess if the film's a big success, then the story's emotional manipulations will have proven to be successful at the box office. I do think, though, that that's the one thing keeping this film from being great.
Well, the frustrating thing about it is that it doesn't need that storyline, in my opinion, because he is doing so much visually that works in terms of story that it could have been strong enough on its own. And I'm thinking of one shot, which is the defining shot for me, is that moment where she finds an escape pod at some point just before her air runs out in her suit. And this happens fairly early on, so we're not giving
I think it's on the International Space Station.
I believe that's right. And she takes off that suit, and we have nothing but the sounds you talked about, Adam. No dialogue. Clooney is nowhere around, thank goodness. And it's almost a bit of ballet that she performs because she's in zero gravity and she's slowly spinning. She's just escaped with her life and she kind of holds herself quietly and floats. And it's this beautiful, mesmerizing image of rebirth that says everything we need to know and has me completely hooked. I didn't need to know anything about her life on Earth at that point. That would have done it for me.
Yeah, but even that is something, Josh, that speaks to the heavy-handedness of the dialogue in the sense that I, too, loved the beauty of that moment, but it's so clearly this fetal position rebirth
image. It worked for me.
That, yeah, it worked, but you think about it later and you think, man, could it have been any more on the nose? Of course it is. So I have mixed feelings about it. I did love the image in the moment. I think where it sounds like we definitely disagree, Josh, and Michael, we may as well. I don't have a problem at all with the emotional backstory or that it was introduced. And you say that Cuarón just didn't need it. The fact is, Josh, it's very clear by the end of the film that the reason this movie isn't a survival tale, mission gone wrong action movie is because the story they actually want to be telling is the emotional, life-affirming one. They want to be giving
They're
you some kind of message.
They're not telling it well, then.
I agree with you that they fail ultimately in the execution, but I am saying to say they don't need it is to basically say that the entire movie is not what it should be. It's clearly what they're trying to make.
I'm caring how well what they made.
And I agree with you that the execution fails, but I don't think you can say that the entire dramatic trauma part, the tragedy part, just should necessarily be thrown out completely. What should have been done is it just should have been handled better. It just should have been
written.
That's
what I'm saying. It's a weak point.
Well, okay, you're saying you would have preferred the movie without it completely. I'm saying I would have preferred it if we didn't get lines like one where after Clooney has learned of the tragic backstory, there's a moment where it's a very key dramatic moment where she's hanging on to him and he says to her, "You have to learn to let go." And I don't think I'm spoiling anything too much in this particular moment. He says, "You have to learn to let go." Now, it's entirely possible that that character in that moment might sort of psychoanalyze her and give her some kind of life-changing statement. It's more likely he just would have said, "You need to let go." Like, let go. And we as an audience can fill in all the blanks. So, you know what? it didn't need to hit us with that kind of sledgehammer force that it does. Otherwise, though, leave out that moralizing. I still think you can leave that story intact to inform the action that plays out. I just wish, like I said, it had been handled more gracefully.
See, and I would argue that dialogue that's on the nose in a film is much more harmful than imagery that's on the nose, which is maybe why the rebirth scene works a little bit better for me. But I think we should spend a little bit of time on the score itself, because it is quite unique. It's the theme for our top five as well. And my impression of it, I had a problem with how they used it. I really liked the sounds that it created and how it wasn't traditional movie score at all. And it did emphasize the sense of panic and confusion. But at the same time, it seemed to be at odds at moments with the reality of the situation. Mm-hmm. Specifically, what the movie points out itself at the very beginning, and you alluded to, is that there is no sound in space. Well, we get this emphasized when the debris crashes into the shuttle and causes all the havoc. We don't hear anything. We see it happening, and we're trained, we're accustomed to hear crashing sounds.
And the score is kind of doing it for
us. But the score does it. And it kind of seemed to work at odds with me, is if we're really trying to have this realistic audible experience, then we shouldn't have the score there either. I don't know if that struck anyone.
I like what the score is doing. To me, that's a fairly artful solution to this no sound. You know, somewhat is kind of an attempt at verisimilitude. Not having walked in space myself, but I do like the music in this. It's not music that really, I think, lifts the film to another interpretive level. It's just more just a clever solution to that problem. I very much like the fact that it's not conventional movie music, because that would sound way off for a film that, you know, again, love it or simply like it very much. This film is not a conventionally structured and kind of audience button pushing blockbuster. It's just not. I mean, it may well be a blockbuster. It may well be changing the rules of cinema as we know it. To me, I'm still not sure. I just wonder. It's like any technological leap forward in the movies. I mean, this is that. This is a technological leap forward, because when they started this thing, they didn't have the effects technology to pull off any of what they were doing. But they have it now. Now, what is going to be done with it? You know, people kept saying Avatar, game changer. Well, yeah, in the dominant way it changed the game, we got a hell of a lot of cruddy 3D, you know, post-production markup 3D. As a result, it didn't change anybody's game, really. I mean, it changed Cameron's personal economic game, you know, but that was about it.
For me, Josh, I really appreciated the overall sound design. I think we've all touched on various aspects where it worked. The sensory nature of this film is so important, so sound is a big part of that. But actually, the score didn't work for me overall with this film. It was a bit of a distraction. I actually felt like, as we're talking about things that were maybe too heavy-handed, it's overly sentimental at times. It seems overly gushing and emotional at times. It actually didn't ever surprise me, which is what all of my picks that we're going to get to in my top five did at various points. And it also didn't do what those picks did for me, which is they added something. They added some new bit of texture, some new color to the film. They actually elevated it. This one just seemed like yeoman's work. It's exactly what the film maybe needed, but it doesn't necessarily make the film better. So it didn't quite work for me. But I do have to go back, Josh, to your point about the gender dynamics in the film, because just frankly, it drives me a little bit nuts. If I was a filmmaker listening to you talk about that, I would think I should pretty much stay away from ever having a male and female character on screen
from emphasizing that aspect of their relationship if you don't want it to be an issue.
Josh, it's so set up in this film that he's the veteran man in space.
I'm fine
and
with
she's
that.
The new person in space. Who is she going to take cues from but him? And it just seems like, talk about not being able to win for Kron. It's not enough that Bullock is smart. She's resourceful. She's strong. She's the hero of the story, who at no point expresses any desire in any kind of romantic relationship with a man, Clooney or otherwise. So she's not defined in any way by that. The fact that she takes some instruction from him, the fact that he's sort of a calming presence in the film, how is that remotely troubling?
The fact that it makes her the hero is what puts the rest of it in stark relief. It makes the rest of it stand out even more. But go ahead, Michael.
I do think there's an undeniable kind of paternalistic air to this film. There's no question. I mean, whatever. People can kind of on that one. But I do think that the setups are what they are, and you guys agree on that. That this is, you know, you can just state it on paper. Okay, this is older male, you know, sort of wiseacre, you know, about to retire, you know, just like Danny Glover in the Lethal Weapon movies, practically. And then yeah, the sort of the younger, although not, you know, the, one of the great pleasures.
Danny Glover would have been better actually. Now that you mention it,
well, Danny Glover's a good actor. So
I think one of the satisfactions of the film though is to see two 50-ish movie stars.
Yeah.
Playing characters their own age. Now, again, is the Matt Kowalski character a freshly conceived character? I'd probably argue no.
Right.
But I would also argue that Clooney handles it a lot better than the guy that they were trying to get, Robert Downey Jr., because I think that would have whacked the film out completely.
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 He's kind of doing Downey Jr., though, now that
little,
you say that.
Yeah,
I didn't know that, but that's how he's playing this.
I do think there's something in the writing that you just can't, there's only so hard you can work against what's on the page.
Perhaps, except I've seen Clooney do other stuff, and he could have tried to go in another direction.
Yeah.
I don't want to blame this on Clooney and say he can only do Clooney. He can only do Danny Ocean, because we know he's capable of more, but he definitely goes in two different gears.
I think
this is the wrong gear.
Overall, George Clooney is a very limited actor, and he's had limited success. There are some roles of his I really appreciated. But I would say, Josh, and I'm not arguing this is my favorite George Clooney performance or I think his best overall acting job, but if there was ever a role that was written for George Clooney's strengths, it's absolutely this one.
Maybe that's part of the problem. It's
maybe
written
it is.
For the Clooney
easy,
persona.
But it requires almost no emoting. He has no need to impart a sense of any big wheels turning in that beautiful big head of his. They just need him to exude steely focus and charm. Just charm. And you know what? He does, because he banters with the best of them. And I think that his stories, actually for me, where we completely disagree on kind of the function of Clooney and his character in the movie, I think, is that I think his constant desire to fill that dead air with his voice and his stories reveals just as much about him as a character and his backstory as Sandra Bullock's desire for quiet and stillness reveals about her. I think he provides a perfect ballast and a perfect foil, an interesting counterpart to Bullock's character that really does balance out the film. I like the fact that we have two completely different people. And so I thought he nailed that stuff. I really do. Now, there's a key scene, I will say, later in the film where everything about his delivery in some of those instances did bother me. But that's me being nitpicky about Clooney, which I always am. He sometimes bugs me on screen. But talking through that headset, being the charming banter guy, he nails it.
Well, and let me just say before this gets too overblown is that this isn't something that was bothering me heavily throughout the film. It was something that was in the back of my head. And the movie itself did keep insisting on for me. His last appearance in the film is why I felt it's worth bringing up, because that completely changes, and we can't really get into how that's handled. But the fact that he is key to where the movie goes from that point on is why it stuck with me and was a distraction.
Yeah, unfortunately, we can't get into spoilers.
Maybe
because,
bonus at some
maybe
point.
Maybe a bonus
we'll
because I just think that there's a crazy dynamic in that scene that makes it tough necessarily to just put that on Clooney, but that's being really vague there. I will say that two of my favorite moments in the movie involve Clooney, and they happen in one scene, but it's really more Coran's doing than it is Clooney, and it's when she does reveal the tragedy from her past. He not only turns his music off finally and just sort of gives her the respect to actually listen to what she has to say, but then you notice he looks down at his spacesuit and he's got a mirror on his sleeve, and he's actually, even though she's way behind him, he's actually able to see her through the mirror, and it doesn't add anything. It's not as if he can see her face,
but it's another really interesting shift in perspective.
It's a shift in perspective,
and
it also
gives us a sense of space.
It gives you that whole sensory thing where it matters somehow just to be able to look at her in that space. It actually does matter to make that kind of connection.
Well, think about all the amazing shots where it's such a relief to see something out there. And the characters emphasize this
right.
too. Can you see the station?
Us
can
and
you
them.
See Earth?
Yeah.
And how that is as valuable as air to them in a way.
Well, Gravity is out now in wide release in 3D and on IMAX screens. I agree. I would love to see it in IMAX form. If you see it or if you have seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. You have to do it in your best George Clooney charming banter voice. You can also find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Tom Hanks' best performance is the subject of this week's Film Spotting poll, up next. And I promise no humming as we reveal the voting results of the John Williams death match. Then we'll get a jump start on our top five lists, movie themes. Stay with us. Hey everyone, jumping in here for a minute to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM10.
And we got this testimonial from Al Grego in Holland Landing, Ontario, Canada. I've been listening to the show from the beginning and have donated in the past, but not for a while. And I just wanted to let you guys know that my podcast subscriptions have changed dramatically over the years. And as I've dropped and added shows according to my changing tastes, this one has survived all the others, never leaving my queue. Your discussion on film is illuminating, and I feel you've had a profound influence on the type and caliber of film I choose to spend my time and money on now. But as I promised, he didn't write in, Josh, just to praise us. He does have praise for Squarespace.
Yeah, Al went on to say, I've also recently decided to give one of your sponsors a try. When I formed my new cover band last year, we needed a website to promote the band and the comic strip that I had created based on that band. Despite having a background in web design and development already, I didn't really have the time to commit to building a site that would measure up to my expectations. So thanks to your show, I decided to give Squarespace a try. I wanted a site that was both flexible and simple enough to use with tools that were both advanced and easy to use. Squarespace fit the bill perfectly.
So my ears did perk up a little bit when Al mentioned a cover band, Josh, of course, me being someone who is in a cover band. If you can call it that when you only play once a year, maybe twice, if somebody is really desperate to hear us. But the website, if you want to learn more, if you're in the Holland Landing, Ontario area, is theroyalpainsband.com. They do have some upcoming gigs. And I looked at their song list because, Josh, you know, occasionally I do make it to the Toronto area. I make it to the Ottawa, Ontario area. And I did a little Google map searching. Unfortunately, far away from Holland Landing. I probably will never have an occasion to be there. But if I was and they ever needed a fill-in rhythm guitarist or bass player, I looked at that list, and I can fill in on Don't Look Back in Anger by Oasis.
Nice.
I also know Mr. Jones by The Counting Crows. So
sure you do.
I could have filled in, but alas, that will probably never happen. But again, if you want to check out the website, and if you want to check out Squarespace, they're constantly improving their platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. They got great designs to start with, but then you have lots of options to create a unique website just for you. And that's one thing based on looking at a lot of listener websites. They're all very different. It's not as if they all just sort of come in a box and they all feel exactly the same. It's very easy to use. You've got support that's there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it all starts at just $8 a month. That even includes the free domain name if you sign up for a year. And this is a big thing, of course, everyone using their mobile devices, their smartphones to access the web these days. Every web design via Squarespace includes a unique mobile experience that matches the way your website looks. So whatever content you put up there on your site, it will look great on every device every time.
You can start a trial without registering a credit card. Just go ahead, start building your website. And then when you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM10 to get 10% off now and to show your support for Film Spotting. We thank Squarespace for their support. Squarespace has everything you need to create an exceptional website.
My name's Forrest, Forrest Gump. Do you want a chocolate? I could eat about 1.5 million of these. My mom always said life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're gonna get.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Just for all the Forrest Gump haters out there, we had to have that clip transition back into the segment and set up our poll question coming a little bit later, where we're going to ask you about your favorite Tom Hanks performance. I mean, we didn't just pick Forrest Gump. We picked the clip from Forrest Gump.
Had to go with the box of chocolates.
Absolutely. I think Sam, our producer, just sometimes likes to torture our listeners. Right now, though, it's time for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this.
Morning, Harry. Have a good night.
Hey, Marlo. Hey, you know those girls that live next door to you? You know what I think? I think they're a couple of lesbians. That's what I think.
Oh, yeah, what makes you say that?
Well, look at them up there doing all those contortions together and with no clothes on.
Oh, they're just doing yoga.
What?
Yoga. I don't know what it is, but it's yoga.
Yeah, what do they do for a living?
They dip candles.
What?
Yeah, they got a cute little shop over on Hollywood Boulevard. They dip them and sell them.
I can remember when people just had jobs.
That was Elliot Gould as Philip Marlowe and David Arkin as Harry in The Long Goodbye from 1973, written by Lee Brackett and directed by Robert Altman.
A movie I absolutely adore, and it was great to get the Massacre Theater entries over this past week because we saw so many people mention this was a film spotting discovery. They never would have seen this movie and ended up loving it, almost all of them, if it wasn't for this show and the fact that we've praised it quite a bit. So loved getting those emails. We heard from Matt Cavanaugh in Tinley Park, Illinois, who said the tie-in is with this week's top five musical themes. The film's score is unique in that it features a variation on a single theme. The theme is played in a variety of different musical styles, both as the non-diegetic score and as diegetic music that inhabits the world of the film. The theme was composed by who else? John Williams, also tying in with the poll question from last week. The question here is, which is your favorite version of the theme? I can't decide between the Muzak version that plays in the grocery store as Marlowe searches for curry brand cat food or the funeral march down in Mexico.
Actually, I love just Jack Riley, the guy who was Mr. Carlin on the old Bob Newhart show, just doing that lounge piano version at the saloon. I mean, that's fantastic.
It is such a good movie.
Too late you turn your head. You know you said the long goodbye.
Well, that was the connection we were going for. Jordan Soika from New Orleans, though, had another one. I don't know if this was the tie-in, but immediately after the performance, you played the trailer for The Fifth Estate, based on Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, a man of questionable morality in a world of even more questionable morality, just like Detective Marlowe.
Definitely not what we were going for, but we'll take it, Jordan. We also got another one from Patrick Sullivan right here in Chicago. On the show, you discussed the Jogo Lev film. Speaking of nicknames, if I can call him
The Batch. That's a new one to me.
We're going to call Joseph Gordon-Levitt Jogo Lev.
Okay.
His film, Don John. One of the tie-ins is with the great Rian Johnson film, Brick, also starring Jogo Lev, which, like The Long Goodbye, takes Raymond Chandler as its inspiration.
Oh, I like that.
So there you go. All sorts of tie-ins we weren't anticipating. If you do want to hear that scene and our top five Chicago Film Fest movies, the one we're most anticipating from the festival that just kicked off actually this past Thursday, you can hear that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Josh, we did get more entries this week.
I saw that.
The fact that the film spotting love for this movie did come through. Many people had seen it, and I think we tripled the previous week's entries, so that was rewarding to see. Reach in and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Ben Howarth from Austin, Texas.
Congratulations, Ben. A longtime listener of the show. Great to see him finally win a Massacre Theater. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, Ben, and we'll set you up with your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Ta-tay-tee-toe-too.
No, no, Miss Lamont. Round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
All right, we have the pleasure of Michael Phillips' participation this week for Massacre Theater, getting to play an icon, I'll just say that. Massacre Theater is presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent, foreign, and classic cinema. More information is at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
So we do have a three-person scene here, and we'll give you a little bit of a hint. It ties in, like last week's scene, with this week's top five are musical themes, or think about famous movie scores. And you mentioned Michael getting to play an icon. I think he probably does. Do I have the more iconic part, though, actually?
In this film? Boy, hard to say.
Yeah, that's
true. It's one
of
the great things about this film.
That's true. But really, I'm just going to try to challenge this guy.
Let's just say I'm nobody.
How dare you?
That's inarguable.
Well, with that, let's go ahead and give it a start. Josh, you're going to kick it off, so I'm going to give you the action. And action.
Villages like this, they make up a song about every big thing that happens. Sing them for years.
You think it's worth it?
Don't you?
It's only a matter of knowing how to shoot a gun, and nothing big about that.
Hey, how can you talk like this? Your gun has got you everything you have. Isn't that true? Well, isn't that true?
Yeah, sure. Everything. After a while, you can call bartenders and faro dealers by their first name. Maybe 200 of them. Rented rooms you live in, 500. Meals you eat in hash houses, 1,000. Home, none. Wife, none. Kids, none. Prospects, zero. Suppose I left anything out? And scene.
It doesn't quite describe your situation at home, does it, Adam?
No, it doesn't, but I've never felt cooler.
I'd actually like to apologize for every actor not actually born in this country just for making fun of like almost every dialect on the globe.
You guys were combining some different ones there. And
yeah. I always end up sounding like Sigrumon, you know.
Well,
that's all right.
Yeah. That's why we bring you on, Michael. We need to fill that void here on this show. If you know what film we just massacred, and I have a feeling many of you do, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, October 14th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries, and
and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
That's John Williams conducting the London Symphony Orchestra doing the Cantina Band tune from Williams' Star Wars score. And last week on the show, anticipating our top five this week, we did ask you to pick between two iconic John Williams scores. The question simply was, which theme do you save? You can only save one. There's Raiders of the Lost Ark or there's Star Wars. Josh, how did it come out?
It went to Star Wars. 67% of the vote.
Yeah. Pretty much how we predicted it. I figured maybe a 70-30, maybe as high as 80-20.
But there might have been some confusion, too, in how people were voting.
Yeah, it's true. We almost left out Star Wars and went more with a triple death match. We were going to go with Raiders, Jurassic Park, and maybe Close Encounters. In the end, these seemed like the two most iconic. But yeah, not surprisingly, listeners maybe went with their hearts, went with their nostalgia, and went with the earlier film there, Star Wars. And it's true. We probably should have clarified that we were meaning to pick just a single theme and not the overall scores. Listeners definitely didn't want to lose all of the music from Star Wars. And we're going to hear from some of those listeners now, like Chris Hubbs in Hiawatha, Iowa. He says, this week's deathmatch question depends a lot on how you frame it. If you're simply voting for the most memorable theme, Raiders of the Lost Ark might well be my choice. But if you evaluate the whole soundtrack, how can you not vote for Star Wars? Does anybody really remember anything from Raiders except the title theme? One can reasonably argue that the Star Wars main theme isn't even the most memorable theme from the Star Wars soundtrack. That Cantina Band and the Imperial March are both fantastic. Luke's theme is used throughout the film, and the throne room slash end title bit is amazing in its own right.
I think Close Encounters of the Third Kind is better than either of them, but there you go. And that was Williams, too. How dare you do this, says Ben H. All your other death matches were so easy to me compared to this. But when it comes down to it, what do you remember about the Indiana Jones music besides the main theme? Even if the theme was gone forever, we still have the Superman theme, which has a shockingly similar melody but very different tone. If you eliminate Star Wars, you not only kill the main theme, but you kill the Imperial March, the Cantina song, and the Battle of Hoth. Boy, this guy knows this stuff. You'll even lose Duel of the Fates from the otherwise god-awful Episode One, which, despite the bad film it's used in, is still one of the coolest themes of the 90s. For me, that's just way too much brilliant music to be lost forever at the sake of one arguably incredible theme song.
Gregory from Jakarta had some other semantics issues. I take issue with the reasoning of those who are giving the edge to Star Wars based on the Imperial March and music from sequels. Since the poll question lists the singular movie title, Raiders of the Lost Ark, I believe the spirit of the deathmatch is one film versus film. Therefore, I'm treating the Star Wars choice to mean only the original Star Wars film, i.e. A New Hope. Having said all that, I'm still going with Star Wars. Star Wars has the better overall score, while Raiders has the better main theme.
Before I read the next listener comment, I do feel the need to interject for all those Team Josh people out there. Just remember, Episode One, Josh Larson's a fan.
I'm a fan of all of the prequels.
All of the prequels.
That's right.
That's right. Josh
really?
Larson. So remember, Team Josh, wearers of t-shirts.
Hey, I've taken it for how many years now? A little bit more isn't going to hurt.
Joel from Georgia says, my wife and I have an unspoken rule. If someone sings the, for lack of a real title, Force theme from Star Wars while reaching towards the remote, a piece of candy, or anything else that is across the room and out of reach, the other person has to get up and get it for them. That's how the Force works. And that's just one reason that Star Wars has to win this poll.
Keeping marriages intact all over the world. That's amazing. Corey says, I'd love to have picked Raiders just because I know it's going to get crushed. And it is great, but how can you pick against what is arguably the greatest score ever?
Yeah, I guess we'll close this out with this comment from Michael Solid Muldoon Conway.
This death match wasn't difficult at all. Star Wars. Now, if you had matched Star Wars against Jaws, I'd still be debating. That being said, how great is the Raiders theme? I worked on the Indiana Jones stunt show at Disney World for nearly 2 years. The Raiders theme was played on a loop all day long. All of us in the cast thanked little baby Jesus every day that it was such a great theme. Otherwise, we might have literally gone mad. Oh, man.
Well, I think that at least does work as somewhat of a defense for Raiders the Lost Ark, which did get thumped in our poll question. We're going to go on to this week's poll question. It is not a death match. You have multiple options here, five or six of them anyway, as we are looking forward to our review next week on the show of the new Paul Greengrass movie starring Tom Hanks. It's called Captain Phillips, though that is how Michael forces me to refer to him when we're off air. I thought it was about you.
I don't mind going
Cappy.
Or Captain. You know, the
Cap'n.
Cap'n Crunch.
Yeah,
got it.
Yeah, there you go.
So the question is simply, what is Tom Hanks's best performance? Not necessarily your favorite. What do you think his best performance is?
As Andrew Beckett in Philadelphia, or as Forrest Gump? How about Captain Miller from Saving Private Ryan? And then two more choices here, Chuck Noland from Castaway and Woody from Toy Story.
We didn't give an other, and a little bit of a tease here, I might actually end up going other.
We don't have another, you can't.
Okay, fine. Well, I'm going to leave my answer for next week when we hear the results. Michael, you will not be here next week. Do you want to weigh in with a choice for which one of those is your favorite Tom Hanks performance?
I would reject these and go with one of the earlier ones that got him going in the first place, something like Splash.
Yeah,
honestly.
He's great.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen that film in a long time.
No, me neither.
I just want to see how good his comic chops are right from the beginning of his movie career.
Yeah.
We are going to have to add other.
Yeah. I even sort of like movies like The Money Pit and just that manic sort of Tom Hanks energy.
Yeah,
he's
I don't
so
like
funny.
That.
I mean, it's not a great movie.
Yeah, I got a bad
Splash
buzz
is better.
I got a bad buzz.
He's fun, though. He's fun in that role. He's fun in a lot of early roles and later roles. And Sam did pose this question to us here as a little addendum. Is it possible that Hanks's last quote-unquote great performance was really in the year 2000? Because you can look at Castaway. A lot of people regard that as a really good performance. Obviously, a little bit of a high-wire act being all by himself there. But if you look at his recent films, Cloud Atlas, Da Vinci Code, The Terminal, Catch Me If You Can, that's where I think Sam is off. Is not only do I think Catch Me If You Can is a good movie, that even with his Boston accent in that film, I think he's great, Catch Me If You Can. So I'd go back at least to 2002.
Yeah, I think I'd have to go to Castaway, actually.
Really?
Well, he's just not as much of a force in Catch Me If You Can. The performance is good, but it's not as key to the film.
So it's not great.
Not great.
Okay. Well, we want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. What better way to transition into this week's Film Spotting Top 5 movie musical themes than to hear those famous sounds from The Godfather Waltz by Nino Rota, a theme that probably would have been at least an honorable mention for all of us, if not a top 5 contender, but alas, The Godfather is in the Film Spotting pantheon. So, at least Josh and I, Michael, have ruled out The Godfather and many other films that we will list here in a moment that have great scores, but unfortunately just aren't eligible because we've put them aside. They're just too great to be considered.
You can't even
top
talk
five.
About their music. You can't break the music
no,
away from
no,
them.
No, no, no. We've already talked about it way too much.
You guys actually agree on that. That's good.
Yeah,
good.
For once, good. We agree on something there. And speaking of honorable mentions, Michael, being the real music buff that you are when it comes to movies, that was a big reason why we wanted you on this particular show. You're going to discuss some more of your honorable mentions in our bonus content.
So many of them are from the same composers that ended up in my top five, and it just broke my goddamn heart to say, which one do you go with? I mean, we could all do a top five on Bernard Herrmann
you
alone.
Could. Exactly.
Nina Rota, any number of these guys. Alex North, one of my favorites, and there's even, in some cases, like in the case of Alex North, there's two different themes from the same movie that I just adore equally, and they serve completely different purposes, and they're fantastic. They're just really it's some of the greatest movie music ever composed, and we'll discuss.
Yeah,
we'll discuss.
So if you really love what you're hearing as we get into our top five themes and you want to hear even more, you can get that bonus content by going to filmspotting.net, click on the apps page, or buy the app for the Windows 8 phone or Android phone or the iPhone. You can get it. Just do a search in iTunes or those various stores, and you can buy the Film Spotting app and get that extra bonus content there. With that, I think we can probably just jump into the top five. We did decide, instead of scores, we're not really looking at the totality of the soundtrack or multiple scores. We really did try to refine it down to those key themes.
Key
and they
themes.
May not even be, Michael, the theme,
right.
The title theme.
Right.
It just might be that recurring motif.
I'm glad you said that because it's not. We're not just talking about main title music.
Or end credits.
Yeah. Not. And also, I think we also agree that we're off the table for this discussion was a great song written for a movie musical.
Right.
I mean, that's another list. Because if that weren't in, then I would have gone with Rodgers and Hart's Isn't It Romantic from Love Me Tonight, because I mean, talk about a theme that won't leave you alone, but it's a song so great that you don't mind being bugged by it all, you know, during the entire film. But anyway, off the table.
Yeah,
off
we are on the same page here. Let's begin. Your number five movie theme.
Michael Giacchino, I think, is my favorite living and really active Hollywood film composer right now. And his scores, particularly for Pixar's Ratatouille and Up, and when you roll in his work for Pixar's The Incredibles, he's 51% of the reason I adore the best of Pixar. And he's five steps up from the other people kind of working in that stable, like Thomas Newman, who are, you know, done some wonderful work too. But I think my favorite theme is the main theme you hear in Ratatouille. It sounds like hyperbole, but I think Giacchino's really are Puccini. I think he writes melodies so simple and direct and moving. You hear him once, and you think this is a classic. And I just don't say that about too many composers, where you just think all it really took was one hearing, and you think, wow, it's a completely inevitable simple melody. And when you hear it, you'll know what I'm saying. So that's my number five.
Yeah, I saw a lot of support for Giacchino's Up when I put this out on Facebook, a lot of fans out there for his work. When I thought about this, I should probably say at the front, it's not an area of passion for me as it is for you, Michael. It's something I have to kind of remember to consider and think about how it works with the film. So that's what this list really forced me to do, especially when it came to themes. And I just kept coming back to this idea I have of movies as being their own living, breathing entities, apart from even their stars, which are their faces, or the directors, which we think of as their authors, and rightly so. Just they're their own things. And so in that sense, these themes to me are kind of that personal theme song maybe you had when you were like middle school or an early teenager, where you're like, yeah, that's my music. That's my song. That defines me. That's what I thought of here. These themes, that's what they are for these movies. And I'm going to start with someone at number five that you mentioned, Michael, Alex North, especially when we talked about 2001, how he wrote a score for that wasn't, of course, eventually used by Kubrick. I'm going to go with a pick that comes from before 1968, however, going back to 1951 for A Streetcar Named Desire, the main title composition. This is Tennessee Williams' play with Marlon Brando and Vivian Leigh doing a lot of screaming, a lot of sweating in New Orleans. And North brought this really appropriately discordant, jazz-infused sound to the score. I think the main title comes back a little bit throughout the film.
It
seems to me, if I'm remembering correctly, when we're outside in the street life that's going on in New Orleans, we get a lot of this coming back. And it's a real mix of styles, it seems to me. There is this traditional undertone to it that has that ominous sense of drama that we get from a lot of scores. But then there are these jazz horns that just blare in and out unexpectedly. And it really works well, at least for me. It's like being right in Blanche DuBois' head.
That's a great description of it. And that's a really, really influential score, because the 50s, all of a sudden you had all this as you say, discordant and really vivid jazz. You know, at the movie theater. I mean, especially with something like Elmer Bernstein.
Where it hadn't been before.
No, you listen to Elmer Bernstein's, this is a theme that did not make my list, but Bernstein's theme for The Man with a Golden Arm. I mean, it's unthinkable without North's work on Streetcar. And again, Bernstein a couple years later with Sweet Smell of Success. I mean, they're all of a piece.
Well, when I was forming my list, as you said, Michael, you can almost just pick some of your favorite composers, and then it's a matter of trying to narrow it down to the one that stands out, whether it's Herman or others. There's also the sense that you could go with genres, because there are some genres that just elicit the most interesting scores, or at least really memorable ones. And I think one of those is the horror genre. And I was trying to pick maybe the horror theme that really stood out for me. And ultimately, it was a film that we did review here on the show as part of a horror marathon about 5 years ago, and I think is not only a great horror film, but a great film. It's Halloween.
Is this a special one finger category?
Basically, you're right. And you know what? It is simple and it is repetitive, but I think that's part
of... You consider degree of difficulty.
I think that's part of the charm of it, Michael, because...
No, it does work.
Yeah, it totally works. There's almost this Mission Impossible, like, ticking clock sense to it, where it does make you think of a notion of finality and a little bit of fatalism. There's that repetition, of course, of that pattern over and over again. It does shift notes. It shifts position a little bit, but it really is that pattern over and over again. It's sort of like Michael Myers himself. It's relentless.
Really?
It's just going to keep coming for you.
And
it's also,
and it's not dumb scare music.
No, it really isn't. It's also, time signature-wise, it's in 5/4, which is something that's a little bit hard to notice, but if you do pay attention to it, it isn't your standard 4/4, so it gives it that sense because it's an odd time signature. It just adds this extra little bit of element of creepiness. Something is just slightly off with it.
I will say, though, that I'm not going to give it away, but if you're actually thinking that's more significant or more interesting music than the really classic horror film score by Bernard Herrmann for Alfred Hitchcock.
Well, no, but
60,
unfortunately,
Psycho,
too obvious a pick for my list.
Oh, yes. You're too obvious. You're above.
No, obvious. Not above it. I'm below it. I'm below Psycho, Michael. That's why I didn't pick it. I had nothing interesting remotely to say about it. Okay. So unfortunately, I'm sticking with Halloween. But like I said, I do think that time is important because just like the movie where it's sort of like a normal teenage Halloween night, well, no, it's not. There's something off. There's something off with the music as well. And I do love that theme. So for me, it's Halloween. That's my number 5. Michael, you're number 4.
My number 4 comes from Mr. Alex North, Josh's streetcar guy, and this is the one that just was one of the toughest. Just talk about a death match. The main title for Spartacus, 1960, is a long piece of music because it's a fairly lengthy title sequence. Brilliant, Saul Bass did the title. The title design, amazing, and it's one of the most interesting epic scores ever written. Anyway, just because it's kind of. It's got this fatalistic edge. You hear it in all the martial fanfare of the opening sounds. It's just you already know it's a losing battle for the slave revolt, but it's subtle, and the music is rousing and also kind of fatalistic at the same time. Nonetheless, it lost out to one of my favorite straight-ahead love themes in Hollywood, which is the love theme from Spartacus, which is underscoring the forest sequences between Kirk Douglas and Gene Simmons. As a critic and as a movie lover my whole life, I've always kind of gone for moments, whether the musical or visual or whatever, that are kind of getting at more than one thing, that are somewhat complicated. Mm-hmm. And yet, when I think of like at least these first two, the Giacchino theme from Ratatouille or also Giacchino's theme from Up, and this Alex North love theme from Spartacus, they are just straight and true and completely effective, and I'm just a wreck every time I hear it.
Spartacus, still a Kubrick blind spot for me.
Yeah, me too.
Unfortunately, so we'll have to get to that.
Boy, you guys,
we're horrible.
Not just blind, but deaf and dumb.
Exactly.
Apparently.
Right. I don't know why you put up with us, Michael.
My number 4 comes from Danny Elfman. Now, Elfman's collaborations with Tim Burton, they're probably as much a part of the director's style as anything, really. And his Batman theme would have been a likely pick, but it's bigger than I want. What I usually respond to in terms of theme songs, or at least when I started to think about this, aren't the ones that stand outside of the movie quite so much. And I feel like the Batman theme does that a little bit. It's why I have a little bit of a John Williams aversion, believe it or not, to some of the things he does. So I went with Elfman's main titles piece from 1988's Beetlejuice instead. Has this deranged circus feel. There's that herky-jerky bass line that when you think about it, it sort of moves the way Beetlejuice walks. It's almost modeled after that. And, you know, some people probably actively dislike it because it is a little insistent and aggressively annoying, which, of course, you could say of Beetlejuice, too. That's, you know, the ghoulish ghost played by Michael Keaton. I think it's perfectly in sync, though, with the movie. It really does serve the film
well.
It's
a great pick, and I think his music for, say, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, the first movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's in a similar vein, and it's got that sort of carnival circus air that you get out of the Nina Rota stuff for Fellini, and I'm sure Elfman's a fan, but he adapted it for his own sound.
So many good options. I considered Elfman as well. Batman for me was just an honorable mention, though. My number 4 is the Elmer Bernstein theme from To Kill a Mockingbird. A If you remember the sacred cow discussion the three of us had a while back on the show, it was the only thing the cold-hearted Grinch Josh liked about To Kill a Mockingbird, that opening credit sequence where we hear Elmer Bernstein's music, we see Scout's box open up, those kind of treasures, the things she's collected, and everything about that sequence, mainly because of the music, is so elegant. You get that sense of innocence, the sense of magic and mystery in the melody there, and there is a sense of awe about it, the same way the kids stand in awe of their father, Atticus, as someone who does things they don't quite understand, who shows them how to live and how to be good in the world, but doesn't necessarily explain it to them all the time. Sometimes they are just taking him in and trying to figure things out. It's obviously a really nice contrast, too, after Halloween, where I was talking about the insistence of the pattern and the repetition of it. There's a theme within this To Kill a Mockingbird theme as well. You do hear it repeated, but there's actually this lack of precision with the notes that I love about it, where it's almost like the piano in its twinkling is kind of searching. It's actually trying to kind of find the right notes. It's feeling its way. It's unsure of what note to hit next, just like these kids who, as you watch the film, are kind of so unsure about what they should be doing and the right thing to do all the time. The score just could not be better with that sequence in particular.
So you voted that over Elmer Bernstein's Magnificent Seven theme.
Well, Michael, are you going to question all of my choices?
Speaking of patterns.
Patterns, okay. I'm here to question, you know. Well, I'm actually here to undermine.
Well, we have three more picks. See if I can do better.
Oh, very good.
We'll see if I can do better.
This program brought to you by the estate of Elmer Bernstein.
Well, I'm getting worried that so far no one's mentioned Britney Spears' Ooh La La from Smurfs 2.
Like I said, three more picks.
Hopefully somebody's going to correct that when we come back to finish off our list. Stay with us.
Nation, it is Mitch Chapin, the rest state of Nebraska, at the home of Arbor Day, calling. It is time to pay my dealer. Sounds a little different when you say my, doesn't it? Boom. Love Film Spotting, you know, longtime listener. There, after Maddie left, I was really bummed, and I stopped listening for a while. My daughter Ava was born, my son Holden was on the way, and, you know, took me a year, but I'm back, baby. And I just felt like something was missing in my life. It was you guys. Really appreciate all the insights. Just love listening to the show. A couple quick things. One, Casino, always better than Goodfellas. Every time. And Renaissance Man is a treasure. I've never forgave you for that negativity, Adam. Hope you guys have a great day.
The rare donation voicemail there, Josh. It's nice not to just get written comments, but sometimes some audio feedback as well. You heard Mitch there in Nebraska City, Nebraska. Apparently, it's Tree Campus USA, so you have that.
I did not know that.
And it's interesting to hear him talk about coming back to the show after taking some time away. You know, you lose a co-host. It doesn't feel the same. Maybe just isn't working for you. And then you know what? You come back and you realize that it's kind of the same old show, or maybe it's different in a good way. And you're back. And it's great to have Mitch back. Maybe we have other listeners who went through a similar experience. We'd love to hear from you. Feedback at filmspotting.net.
I didn't scare everyone away, huh?
No, apparently not everyone.
Good.
Just a few people, Josh. But he was doing so good, too, there, Mitch. He was praising the show, and then he had to go say two inane things like Casino's better than Goodfellas and Renaissance Man is a treasure. Renaissance Man, I don't know that this has ever come up with you, Josh, but it did with Maddie and maybe Sam previously. Renaissance Man is one of maybe only two or three movies I've walked out of.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, I was in high school and I was seeing it for free, so I had nothing invested in it. But you want to talk about a movie that gets a little too sentimental and mushy and moralizing. Renaissance Man, finally, about the two-thirds mark, I just said, Danny DeVito, I can't take it anymore.
Yeah, and that Casino claim, too, I don't know if I could go with that either.
There are some people out there, though. There's a handful of people, and I wonder if they're not the people who grew up sort of with Goodfellas.
Could be.
Maybe they saw Casino first, even, but to me, it's always going to be Goodfellas. Mitchell did give us a Silver Club donation, though, and we do thank him again for that voicemail. We also got donations from two new donors this week.
Mark in Norcross, Georgia, and Eve in Brooklyn, New York.
And that's it for donations, actually, though. Of course, we thank all of our monthly donors to the show, and we thank everyone who has been heeding our advice. They've actually been going to iTunes. I think when we started this little pledge drive for iTunes ratings, Josh, we were at 800 and something. And we've been trying to push to 1,000. Mm-hmm. It's just been 3 weeks, maybe four at the most, since we've been mentioning it. And now we're up to, as of right now, 956 ratings.
Almost there.
We're going to hit 1,000 pretty quickly here, and you might just be the listener that puts us over the top. We appreciate, again, everyone who not only helps us there on iTunes, but also donates some of your hard-earned cash our way in support of the show. Two final quick notes. The music. We are featuring some themes this week, themes that didn't make our top five. But in the first break, you heard James Horner's Oscar-nominated score to Apollo 13. It's one that does get a lot of love from score aficionados, and it seemed like the perfect tie-in, of course, with Gravity. Finally, we do want to plug Jeff Goldsmith and his podcast, The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, his long-form interviews with screenwriters. If you want to seek that show out, you need another podcast to listen to. You can find that via iTunes. Just do a search for The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, or you can find a direct link in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net.
Hey, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners. This is Matt Singer from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. And in our latest episode, Allison Wilmore and I try out gritty but fabulous lives as homeless Parisian artists and acrobats as we discuss Leos Carax's The Lovers on the Bridge.
And inspired by that film, we'll also be offering up some recommendations for more films set in glorious Paris that are available online for streaming or rental. To listen or subscribe to the show, check us out on iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
This is Ryan Johnson, the writer and director of Brick, and you are listening to Film Spotting.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam, Josh, and Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. We're in the midst of this week's Film Spotting Top 5 movie musical themes. You're hearing there Henry Mancini's theme to 1963's The Pink Panther, directed by Blake Edwards, and that is one of the many picks, Michael, that you had relegated just to honorable mention status. Not quite top 5 worthy.
And I love Mancini, and just for that theme alone, and for the theme he did for a few years earlier for Orson Welles and Touch of Evil. Mm-hmm. Touch of Evil really falls in with what we were talking about before with Elmer Bernstein and Alex North, is just jazz-soaked, crazy, a really dangerous sort of atmosphere. Wonderful.
Yeah.
But there's something so witty and so elegant and wonderfully exportable, that theme Mancini wrote for that. And he's done great work. If you go back to a movie like Blake Edwards' The Great Race, which was 2 years after that, this big behemoth of a mid-60s comedy, overproduced, you know, some great stuff in it in a way, but the best thing in it is Mancini's music, and not just the main theme, but just even just little flourishes for certain side characters. You know, he's such a good 60s composer, one of the very best.
Well, we've shared our number 5 and number 4 picks. If you missed those and want to go to filmspotting.net, click on the top 5 links. You can see our complete list, plus our archive of Film Spotting Top 5s. Michael, that does bring us to your number 3 theme.
My number 3, I could have picked any 5 of my favorites from Nino Rota. I guess the one that wins for me is the main theme from Amarcord. Thank you. This is not a film I love. And I don't think Fellini even makes my top 15 for directors that mean something to me personally. And I've always argued that I think if you had to, in some sick way, pick who's the more essential film artist, Nino Rota or the director he worked for, I'd go with Rota all the way. I think everything that Fellini's movies tend to push a little too hard and make a little too obvious, Rota's doing in a way that just I find truly magical. And I just laugh. He's like laugh out loud funny as a composer, really witty. And this the circus quality you mentioned, Josh, with, among others, Danny Elfman. I mean, this is Rota was scoring Fellini's visions of clowns and carnivals and life as a circus and sad and funny. But I mean, Rota's themes for, good Lord, everything from La Strada to 8 and a Half, La Dolce Vita. But Amarcord's the one that I keep coming back to.
And if you want to see Amarcord and hear that, it's going to be at the Chicago International Film Festival.
Yeah,
we're
touched
doing a revival
on that
screening. So
during our preview, it is playing at the fest if you want to see it on the big screen.
All right, my number three is actually a song. I don't know if either of you went that way at all, but the music is by Dimitri Tomkin. The lyrics are by Ned Washington. It's Do Not Forsake Me, O My Darling, sung by Tex Ritter for High Noon. And it couldn't be more literal. I mean, it essentially lays out the challenge that's facing Gary Cooper's small town sheriff. He's about to leave to start a new life, just got married, and then he learns this criminal he once put away is coming back to terrorize the citizens of the town.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling. On this our wedding day.
So the movie opens with this song essentially singing that and getting at the emotional undercurrent of it. And it's matter of fact, but, you know, so is Cooper in the role. I love the one line he has when he's making the crucial decision about this and just says, it seems to me I've got to stay. You know, he's just so matter of fact about it. It is a cowboy song for one of the more straightforward westerns you're ever going to see, but that makes it a perfect match for me.
Yeah, that's a very good pick. My number three is from Johnny Greenwood. In his recent collaborations with Paul Thomas Anderson. Could have gone with The Master, because I do love the themes and the score overall from that film, but I'm going with There Will Be Blood, and I'm picking the theme that's called There Will Be Blood. I did consider going with the music you hear over that oil gusher sequence, and we get the fire and everything just breaks loose there, but it's actually not on the soundtrack. That was the whole controversy there, where it didn't get nominated for an Academy Award because he had taken some elements of that from previous material he'd recorded. But when you listen to that There Will Be Blood tune in particular, there's a little bit of a Jaws element to it, where it's that really slow, low rumble. You almost get a little bit of Psycho later too, where you get the high strings and kind of the squeal as things really get to a fever pitch. But I look back at my notes from There Will Be Blood, and you can describe that movie not only obviously as intense, but just muscular. It's just muscular filmmaking, and what you see on screen, everything about it is really raw and physical, and I think this There Will Be Blood theme reflects that. About 50 seconds in, the tone shifts a little bit, and it becomes much more chaotic, and it reflects this notion. I think when you first hear it in the movie, too, is when you're seeing just this barren landscape, and right away it does almost make you feel like you're on another planet. There's an otherworldly sense to the music. I think it's supposed to make you feel that way, where these characters are almost completely detached from society. It's almost like they are in another world, where they're making things up as they go, and there is a certain brutality to that way of life. We certainly see the brutal philosophy that Daniel Plainview has, and I think just that music, the visceral tones, there's something harrowing about it that does reflect the kind of danger of that unsettled landscape. And even the physicality I mentioned in the work we see the characters doing on screen, you hear it in the music, in that low rumble of the strings, where you can feel almost the hands and the arms pulling across the strings. It really is reflected there in that, and the way the brass hit their notes, they really punch those notes in a raw physical way. So I love it.
One of the great things about Greenwood too, and that's a great pick, is he really knows how to compose for stories and keep one foot in the period in which they're set and one foot very much in the contemporary sound.
Yeah,
but you never,
that's a great,
you're never
great point.
And you're never yanked out of the period with his work. It's not, it doesn't smother the movie. And even though the sequence you're describing, that's completely dialogue free, I believe, for many minutes as we see Plainview on his own looking for oil in the desert. Is it oil or gold at that point? I forget.
I think it's still oil.
Mine.
Yeah. No, it's actually maybe some gold. You're right, Michael,
mining.
In that early
scene.
Yeah.
And that's all music. And it's it really does set this striking otherworldly tone. But it's almost like the Dawn of Man sequence in 2001. It's so bizarre. But he's a wonderful talent.
Michael, that brings us to your number two.
All right. Just to be perverse, I'm going to put Bernard Herrmann at number two instead of number one. There's just too damn many Bernard Herrmann themes competing for my affections and my admiration. Everything from Citizen Kane and Magnificent Ambersons at the beginning of his film career up through films, scores people don't really know, like The Ghost and Mrs. Muir. Have you guys seen that film, the Mankiewicz film? That's beautiful, really, really swooning, romantic, and also kind of otherworldly music from Herrmann that the people don't know, and they should seek that out. But, my aside from all the amazing work he did with Hitchcock, there's a theme from a film called Hangover Square. Do you guys know this? Concerto Macabre?
No.
Oh, my God. You got to hear this. It's this cheap Jekyll and Hyde, Jack the Ripper-style melodrama set in Gaslight-era London. And Laird Krieger plays this driven composer who's stuck writing commercial pop tunes, saloon tunes, but he really wants to write a great symphony, right? And you can see why Stephen Sondheim loved this film when he was 15. But he goes through these bizarre trances and kills women at night, and then he wakes up the next morning and he doesn't know he's done it. So I mean, this film is nuts. And at the end, this composer character, finally gets to premiere his grand effort. You know, the thing that will win the heart of the saloon girl. And it's called this Concerto Macabre, and he's playing it as the concert hall is in flames all around him. I mean, this film is out of its mind, and Herrmann's music is just something else. It's in period to some degree, but it's also just pure 40s Hollywood as only Herrmann kind of heard it, and it's all over the place, and yet it's completely of a piece. It's not a great film, but it's somehow, this is quintessential Herrmann. It's also the music that inspired Sondheim's Sweeney Todd.
Really? You've described it, Michael, so evocatively, I feel like I could hear it in my head. Well done.
Thank you.
All right, my number two is Carter Burwell's opening titles from Miller's Crossing, which is probably, I think, still the Coen brothers' best film. It's my personal favorite, at least. This is their 1990 Prohibition-era gangster movie. It has Gabriel Byrne, Albert Finney, John Turturro's in there as well. There's a lot of yelling and violence in this movie, as you might expect, but Burwell's opening piece, it offers this... It's a juxtapositional sort of calm and elegance that's at odds in some way with what else is going on in much of the movie, but it also brings this really deep, deep sadness to the film, which I think is elemental in making this a picture that's more than its surface elements. There's also this gentle whistle to it that keeps coming back to the piece. There is a swelling crescendo that's a little bit more conventional, I would say, but we do always come back to that soft, I'm not sure if it's a flute or a tin whistle, but it does create this sort of gentle cry. And I think what it makes us do is step back and pause for a minute and just regard Miller's Crossing as more than this gangster exercise. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the Coens, especially in their earlier films, are being written off as just going through the motions, genre motions. And there's so much more here. It really does help inflate this picture into a true lament.
A lot of potential good Coen Brothers picks I think you could go with here. My number two, Michael, you had Nino Rota. I went the more conventional route. I do love this film more than you do. It is 8.5. Mm. And as you noted, obviously, he was very famous, Rota was, for his collaboration with Fellini. Also, not only from The Godfather, we heard his collaboration there with Coppola, but worked a lot with Luchino Visconti, very memorably. But for me, it's really all about that Rota-Fellini combination. And because of my love for 8.5, that's where I went. And I found a quote from Fellini today where he described Rota as someone who had a rare quality belonging to the world of intuition. Just like children, simple men, sensitive people, innocent people, he would suddenly say dazzling things. As soon as he arrived, stress disappeared. Everything turned into a festive atmosphere. The movie entered a joyful, serene, fantastic period, a new life, he described working with him on one particular film. And really, one of the things that holds that surreal fantasy that is 8.5 together is that Rota score. You've got flashbacks and present day and these fantasy sequence, and I think that theme really does help keep your bearings throughout, especially memorably at the end where it comes back. It's really integral. But I think those words from Fellini really do perfectly sum up the theme, because it's dazzling, it's festive, it's fantastic in that it does evoke this sense of fantasy. And I do think about the end of the film, the spectacle of all those people, the wonder of it all the people we've met, all these people that have had a role in the director's life. The music just so perfectly matches that, because you've got these swirling layers of instruments. And what he said in particular about that notion of intuition with Rhoda, that's what the music feels like, because just like when you're watching 8½, the images don't necessarily always make a literal sense. This theme doesn't sound like it was meticulously orchestrated. It clearly was. If you break it down, you know it was, and that's there. There's a real artistry to it, but it darts around. It hits a certain sound and kind of follows it, and then comes back and lands on a theme and then goes somewhere else with it. And I just love the way you do get that sense of intuition that he's playing. He's playing, and yet at the same time, it's so clearly well done.
It's almost in the way that something like Carl Stalling used to compose for Warner Brothers Animation, you know, for Chuck Jones shorts or mm-hmm. the Merry Melodies, or where you get like a theme. A really witty, sort of hard-driving theme established, in one direction for 8, 10, 12 seconds, then you're into something else.
Yeah.
But if you have a high-grade composer who can handle those change-ups and just really keep coming up with inventive melodies and just really making you laugh, I mean, there's real joy in Rhoda's music.
Yeah. Well, that brings us to our number one, our favorite, or what we think is the best movie theme ever, Michael. I can't wait to hear it.
All right, today, my favorite...
Ever today.
Today. I mean, Herman yesterday. Today, David Raxon wrote two extraordinary themes in his career as a composer for the movies Laura in 1944 for Otto Preminger, which turned into an enormous hit. And a few years later, a film that's less revered today and music that's not very well known, it's the theme from The Bad and the Beautiful, 1952 Vince Minnelli film. It's a really a bizarre, almost untrackable melody, and this it's a story of these backstabbing Hollywood weasels, and yet, and it's kind of juicy and a little bit campy, but the way that Raxon's theme treats it in the opening credits, it's almost like a Bible epic had a car crash with, was sort of like a Civil War saga. It doesn't sound like it would make any sense in that story, and yet it totally does. And there's also a great story about how it was, I mean, he wrote it, he presented it to Dori Sherry at MGM, the head of the studio, and who hated it, because it's like, where's the melody, guy? Where's the melody? And then just then, Betty Comden and Adolph Green walked in from a different soundstage working on Singing in the Rain, and they were like, we love this thing! And it saved it from being
really?
Thrown away. Yeah, yeah. There's also, if you know the Laura theme, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, he's struggling all weekend, all for weeks with this thing, and Otto Preminger just said, look, I really want to use Sophisticated Lady, the Duke Ellington tune, for this movie, so why don't you just give up? He says, no, give me the weekend. I'll come up with something better than Sophisticated Lady. And nothing. Then Raxon's on the West Coast. His wife is in, I think, a show called Bloomer Girl on Broadway in New York. And he gets mail comes on a Saturday, opens the letter. I've fallen in love with somebody in the show. I'm leaving you. And he sits down at the piano and he writes his theme. Bingo, it's in. So, and then it was a rich man.
Yeah. I do
so
love that film.
Yeah. Laura's great. I love The Bad and the Beautiful too, but the amazing thing for me, guys, is to hear the original Bad and the Beautiful theme as it was heard in the film, more or less, and there's an orchestral suite that's on the kind of the concert rounds, and then you hear Bill Evans' solo piano version, which to me is the most beautiful 2 minutes of music. That's my Desert Island 2 minutes.
That's a bold statement.
It's a bold statement. It's a bold theme.
Yeah, Bad and the Beautiful is a fantastic film. I didn't know, though, Michael, that we had a Kirk Douglas quota here to hit with our top five. That's your number two.
Kirk Douglas.
With Kirk Douglas. So
the music's fantastic.
My new number one is Ace in the Hole. Josh, your number one.
My number one comes from our Blaxploitation marathon, actually. So it's another standalone song like my High Noon pick, but it's the perfect musical encapsulation for what the movie is all about. And this is Curtis Mayfield's Pusher Man from Superfly.
Superfly. So good. All
right. I'm your mama, I'm your daddy, I'm that nigga in the alley. I'm your doctor when in need, want some coke, have some weed. You know me, I'm your friend, your main boy, thick and thin. I'm your Pusher Man.
Mayfield did the whole soundtrack for this movie, which Ron O'Neill stars in as a title character. He's a New York City drug dealer who discovers that his criminal enterprise, it's really just another form of enslavement, is what the movie's really about. So this is a tragedy, and I think Pusher Man, it gets at that with that falsetto cry, and of course the lines too. There's the one line that I always remember, there is no happiness. I mean, just stating that boldly within this movie's story makes a lot of sense. I did say when we gave out our awards for that marathon, Adam, that overall I like James Brown's soundtrack for Black Caesar a little bit better.
Yeah.
But that's taking in the whole soundtrack. If you're just looking at specific themes, you can't beat this.
What about Trouble Man? That, to me, that's the one that can compete.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, maybe.
Marvin Gaye's Trouble Man? What's the one everybody would probably vote for if they haven't heard these other ones is Shaft.
Well, Shaft, well, right, which is good. And
I was just
going to
say, honorable mention for me, I almost did include it in my top five, even though I like Superfly, the song, better. Shaft, for me, I feel like my recollection of it is that they go to it a lot more, maybe, throughout the film. I don't think it's just at the beginning, but we do get it a little bit more.
For Shaft
for Shaft,
Man.
I thought.
Oh, okay.
So I could be wrong about that, but I almost did go Shaft, even though I love Superfly, and I had a feeling you'd go with it, Josh. So great pick. And we go from that great genre, which did produce a lot of great movie music, Blaxploitation, back to another genre for me that's really all about great scores. The genre is film noir. For me, the film noir theme is Miklos Rocha's theme for The Killers, the 1946 film, directed by Robert Siodmak, stars Burt Lancaster and Ava Gardner. Rocha, very famous composer, obviously worked with a lot of people in a lot of different films. He did work with Billy Wilder, and I did consider his score for Double Indemnity. He also worked on The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes and The Lost Weekend. But as I said, for me, the iconic film noir theme is that theme from The Killers. You get that at the opening of the film in the prelude against the stark simplicity of that opening scene. The real stark black and white, that diner and that small town, and the bad guys roll into town and they go to that counter and they're seeking the Swede and trying to find him so they can kill him. And the key theme of that movie for me is this notion that ultimately you're pretty powerless against these larger forces that are out to bring you down. There is that sense of fatalism to it. And Rocha's score is sort of mockingly triumphant. It's very regal in a sense. And it almost feels like it should be too grandiose, but I think that works because it's really ultimately oppressive. I think the oppressiveness of the score works perfectly with that theme. The real staccato horns, they're so loud, they're so staccato, that it's just so in your face that it gives you the sense that as an audience, you can't escape it, just like that Swede character can't escape his fate. And it really does just set you up for that entire film. I mean, it puts you perfectly in the mood and the despair that the title character is going to end up in. It's all there, that opening theme.
These are 40s films mostly that you're talking about, but Rocha, of course, belonged to, and he was active in a decade earlier, but I mean, it's really coming out of that that whole tradition that Max Steiner was working in, and especially Eric Korngold a little later, who did wonderful stuff for things like The Seahawk and The Adventures of Robin Hood. These are all, you know, very kind of classically trained, a hugely imposing sort of sound, big orchestras, and it all started with King Kong. It's not music you put on lightly, but when Steiner wrote the score for King Kong in 1933, that was a movie that had just more acres of sound per running time than people had. I mean, it was like he scored that film very heavily. There's very little non-scored footage into King Kong, and that was part of the gut impact of that picture, along with the visual effects. Those are not my favorites now.
Yeah,
I mean, I think they paved the way big, you know, kind of Viennese or sort of European trained craftsmen, but they paved the way for the guys I really love. And but it all comes from somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
And that's where these come from.
Well, those are our top five movie musical themes. Michael, as we've already promised, we're going to get to our bonus content. Again, if you want to seek that out, go to filmspotting.net and click on apps. You're going to get all of Michael's honorable mentions. Josh, real quick, any couple that you want to mention that were really tough to leave off?
Real quick, there were so many. I guess my Williams pick would have been the theme from Jaws, the main title, because I think that one, it doesn't stand outside the movie like some of his stuff does. It's mm-hmm. so integral. It plays the shark, right? Anton Karas's Zither compositions for The Third Man, I would definitely put on there, except I had that film recently on my Americans Abroad list. Eminem's Lose Yourself from 8 Mile, I considered.
Yeah, see, and I just completely ignored any kind of pop song or...
You did, okay.
Yeah, any song.
Yeah, I was into that, and we didn't talk about it, but that definitely would have been one. And I don't know, can you include the Inception, the boing? Does that count as a theme? Because that
only when
really
you do
works
it.
For me.
I guess.
I like that.
I see the giddiness when you did that, Josh.
That's awesome.
That's impressive. So, Michael, I don't know if you're done haranguing my picks or not
being
critical.
They're largely pretty good.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll take it.
Largely pretty good.
As it turns out, though, way back in July of 2006 here on Film Spotting, we did our top five scores. Mm. And so obviously we're making a little bit of a demarcation here with the themes, but there's the potential for a lot of overlap. So I went back and looked at my list from that show in 2006, and I wanted to be sure to avoid any overlap. So as it turns out, I'll give you real quick the honorable mentions from that show: On the Waterfront, Gladiator, The Right Stuff, Taxi Driver, not yet in the Film Spotting pantheon, The Mission, and I basically just said all the great Leone spaghetti westerns. I love all the Morricone themes, so just honorable mentions. My top five, I had The Last Temptation of Christ.
Uh-huh.
Number four, Platoon, which was a cheat because it wasn't original music for the film, but I love the music they do use. Number three, The Magnificent Seven. Thank you very much.
Good.
Number two, Vertigo, not yet in the Film Spotting pantheon.
Beautiful.
And my number one was the Henry Mancini, Touch of Evil.
Oh,
so did
right.
I do better in 2006?
Yeah, you've gotten dumber.
Okay.
I think I progressively a little dumber.
Okay,
yeah.
I'll take it.
I thought we're all getting there.
Well, we want to hear your comments. Try to be a little nicer, please, than Michael. Take it a little bit easier on me. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and @facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in limited release this weekend. These are all opening in Chicago. There's a lot of them, so I'm going to rush through them. ACOD, it's a comedy starring Adam Scott and Amy Poehler, also Richard Jenkins and Catherine O'Hara. All the Boys Love Mandy Lane. This is a horror film that was originally supposed to come out in 2006 and is only just now coming out. And I guess we could call that a shelf sitter, because that's what our friends at Film Spotting SVU, Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore, called it. And they shared some of their favorite shelf sitters on a recent episode of SVU. If you haven't heard that show, please give it a try. FilmspottingSVU.com. Also out, Romeo and Juliet. Yes, yet another adaptation. The Summit, Two Jacks, and We Are What We Are. Michael, of any of those films, I know you've seen at least one of them, anything you can recommend or recommend people stay away from?
I would avoid We Are What We Are, which is about cannibals, and Romeo and Juliet, you know.
Spoiler.
A lousy play.
Yeah, I mean, really, with that material, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Out in wide release, you can see the number four most anticipated film of the fall, according to one Josh Larson. It is Robert Rodriguez's Machete.
And
Machete Kills, I should say.
Yeah, please, straighten that out. I missed the screening for this, so that means it's going to have to be date night.
And, yeah, well, Debbie's such a lucky woman.
With the
such
kids.
A lucky woman.
Probably.
Also out,
expensive.
Captain Phillips, directed by Paul Greengrass, starring Tom Hanks, the true story of the 2009 hijacking of an American cargo ship by Somali pirates. And that is the movie we plan on discussing next week on the show. Ironically, our captain, Michael Phillips, will not be here for that conversation, but we'll talk about the Greengrass film and share. Right now, our plan is to do our top five hostage movies. I don't know how we've made it through 8 years or whatever it's been and never done that topic, but we're going to give it a shot next week on the show.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Special thanks, Michael, for bringing just a ton of knowledge to this week's top
five. We were
five.
Edified, as usual.
Thank you. I think almost 80% of it was accurate.
Well, that's good, too.
That's better than our normal batting average.
No, thanks, guys. It was fun.
What do you got going on at chicagotribune.com/movies? Some film festival stuff, maybe?
Festival stuff. I got a couple more, a few more features than usual. I talked to Tom Hanks and Paul Greengrass when they came to town for Captain Phillips.
Name dropper.
Yes, and also hobnobbed, for almost 15, 20 minutes with Michael Fassbender and director Steve McQueen for 12 years a slave.
What did he just say?
Man. Up in,
rubbing
up
it
in Toronto.
You were in the same room with Fassbender?
All right.
We've got to bring this to a close.
Adam's getting sweaty.
The bromance is will never end.
I don't know what to say.
For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.